Hello and welcome to Dinis Guarda YouTube podcast series powered by openbusinesscouncil.org and citiesabc.com. Once again, we are here to continue profiling global thought leaders and personalities, pushing the boundaries of technology and business, and the way we think and adapt towards all the innovation, disruption, and as well changes that come with all these different things that happen every day in our daily business and technology lives. And technology is part of our lives more than ever. So today, I welcome to our series, Johnny Fry, that is a high-profile personality in the digital currencies, blockchain, and research and financial industries world and fintech. So Johnny Fry is someone that I know for a long time. And some of the areas that he's been doing, he's been leading the Digital Bytes, the team blockchain with Thomas Power, and as well as a global thought leader in blockchain, cryptocurrencies, ICOs, and fund specialist. He has over 25 years of experience in the proven leadership and management, looking and working with organizations like Premier Asset Management, which he was a manager, and he floated in the London Stock Exchange with over £1 billion under management. He is also recognized as one of the influencers in the crypto AM. So one of the, for people in the UK is quite well known, but for people international, crypto AM is one of the biggest publications, the City of London, 2022 awards. He is the CEO of the Team Blockchain and the UK-based international influencer network that works with a range of services providers such as lawyers, accountants, exchanges, commodity insurances, providers, and private and public companies to offer thought leadership, research and analysis and strategy around these areas of blockchain technologies. He's also a non-executive chairman of GemCap UK Limited that works with fund managers, predominantly with UK and USA, assisting them with strategy, marketing and distribution. And Johnny's expertise has positioned him as a trusted voice within the blockchain community. And he co-founded the British Blockchain Frontier Technology Association, BBFTA, a growing network to increasing the understanding and adoption of blockchain and other frontier technologies. And as an expert and industry leader, he's been very involved in the UK investment industry, including intermediary markets distribution, FCA regulation for mutual funds, stock broking, discretionary management, and a lot of different areas. And as well, he is a sought-after speaker in a lot of events international, and as well, an editor of Digital Bytes, which I suggest for you to read. That is a renowned publication providing in-depth analysis of blockchain and digital asset sector. Again, here we are to continue profiling great thought leaders and personalities changing the world of business, finance, and technology. And as well, especially people that actually can look at ways how we can actually find solutions, look at research and thought leadership that actually can improve the way we engage. I welcome to this series today someone that I've been working with for a long time and someone I deeply respect, Johnny Fry, that is behind a lot of profiles and a lot of different things. Johnny, welcome to our series.
Thank you, Nis. Thank you for inviting me and looking forward to having a chat because there's been lots of things going on since we last spoke.
Indeed. Okay, so Johnny, I want to start. You have a wealth of experience that is amazing, both from technology and finance, from research, from thought leadership, from network business, from building in multiple corporations and organizations, and as well someone that was always in the cutting edge of different areas. So I want to go back to the past. Where did this start? You can start as early as you want, but I want to get a bit of your history on these areas. I always like to start by history of the person.
Yeah, well, certainly. Well, again, thank you, Dinis. So my career really started in the asset management field. I set up a fund management business in the late 1980s, so a long time ago, hence a few gray hairs, I'm afraid, but there you go. And it was really designed to manage money for individuals, but it was sold via financial intermediaries, accountants, solicitors, people like that. And we went on and acquired a stockbroker called Brewin Dolphin. They had a range of unit trusts, and they also had a platform of CCAVs. So it shows you how long it goes, because unit trusts have all gone and they've been replaced by UCITS. So we converted those into UCITS. And along the way, we floated the business on the London Stock Exchange and grew the funds under management. And I was CEO of that business for over 20 years. That's all I'd ever done. And I was keen to try and do something different rather than just purely managing monies. But most of my life, I'd been regulated and obviously running a public company. So I had the twin challenges of a public company and regulation and running a company. And so therefore, I was very, very interested when I started learning about a technology called blockchain, because essentially what blockchain was, in a simplistic way, blockchain is an Excel spreadsheet on steroids, Dennis. We don't need to get too complicated about it. It's more what you can do with the technology that interests me. And one of the first use cases that came to real light, well, apart from Napster back in the sort of 70s, because that was a good example of file sharing and a version of DLT, or distributed ledger technology. But we saw, when I really first got involved in this, 2015 and 16, started looking at, obviously cryptocurrencies. But because of the type of assets that they were creating and the areas they're involved in, that was of less interest to me, because I was not so interested in ICOs, initial coin offerings. But again, I was interested in the technology behind them, and realized that if you could use blockchain, you could create much, much greater transparency. And that transparency would help companies to be more open with their shareholders, with their staff, with their customers. It would help governments and regulators, because they would have better access to raw data. And by having greater transparency, it gives you better trust. So that means you can have lower insurance premiums. And it's not just in financial services. See, very much we're seeing the technology being used in agriculture, in fashion, in healthcare, in retail. And off the back of that, back in 2018, I was asked to write a report for a petrochemical company. And the lawyers asked me to write the report. They did so because they had told them that I'd been looking at some work that IBM had done with QR codes. Now, I'm going to put you on the spot, Dennis. What does QR stand for? Can you remember? I did tell you this a few years ago. We know what it was.
Yes. No, this is actually a very interesting thing. Now, QR stands for, well, the QR, it's a technology that...
what does it stand for?
QR. Quick response codes.
Yes, he remembers. It's amazing, Dennis. People just don't remember. They don't... I know what it does.
Some names, they get part of our stuff and you forget how basic and simple they are.
So what IBM had done, they'd used quick response, i.e. QR codes, to be able to say, well, okay, this milk or this honey or whatever good, this is actually a chain of provenance. We can prove where it's come from, who are the farmers, how ecologically sustainable is it. And as a result of that, people would be prepared to pay up to 39% more for the same product. And so we told this to the petrochemical company, because they are the biggest retailer in the world. They have more petrol stations, more gas stations, and therefore by number of outlets, they're a very big retailer. And they were intrigued by this, and they were very, very keen to sort of learn more. And we did some more work with the lawyers, and they said, well, why don't you do one of this once a month? And so we started looking around in 2017 and couldn't find anyone that was doing anything like this. There were lots of people trying to sell things. There were lots of people doing newsletters whereby it was just cut and paste of press releases. But we created Digital Bytes and did the first one in March 2018. And it was really trying to show who, how, where, and why the technology of blockchain and digital assets were being used, with lots of case studies and lots of, if this has happened, what does it mean next? How does it impact on the industry, or how could it be used in another industry? And so that now goes out to over 20,000 people all across the country, actually all across the world. And we have one of our clients is a Chinese client, and they actually translate it into Chinese and send it via WeChat to Pan-Asian countries that you can't get emails into. So that's a very brief sort of, what I did and sort of where we are now.
Well, congratulations, first of all. It's a fantastic trajectory. So I want to go back to a bit of this history. So like you said, you found, first of all, you started the conventional markets, capital markets, where at the time there were not none of this craziness, and people forget how fast things have been changing in 20, 30, 40 years. And it's becoming impressive, all the changes and the path, especially right now with AI and all the different things. But I want to go back. So from your experience, and you have a lot of experience and wisdom as well on this, what would be the major breakthroughs that you saw from, for instance, from the city of London or New York capital centers to the decentralization where this becomes much more digital, and then when blockchain started? On these three marks, if you want to touch a bit of this history, because I know that you like to look at history and parallels around that, especially as a researcher as well.
Well, yeah, I suppose the main thing is that what we've seen is democratization of financial services. Now that sounds a very flouncy way of putting it, but essentially, what we've now seen is by creating collective investment schemes, you no longer need to make an appointment with your bank manager or with your stockbroker. You can actually have access to very similar investments to very, very wealthy people. And so you can get access to emerging markets or you know, I don't know, US debt products or real estate or commodities, things which historically were very, very difficult to access. And what we've also seen in my lifetime is a shortening in what is known as the T. People talk about T0 or T2 or T4, and that is the time it takes to get your money. Now, when I start investments, I remember we used to have an account period whereby you could buy BP shares on a Monday, and you didn't have to pay for those BP shares for up to 2 weeks later, almost, because you had an account settlement period. Now, if you buy BP shares or any share on the stock market, then you really have to pay within a couple of days. But what we're now seeing is the markets are moving from T plus four, it's gone to T plus two, a couple of days, to T0. Whereby you really can't enter into a transaction unless you can prove you have sufficient funds to pay. And those funds, once you've executed your transaction and bought a share or a bond or whatever it may be, you then have to pay for them immediately. And this makes markets much, much more efficient. And it also reduces the risk. So it's funny, what we're seeing with the digital assets is that we're actually going back in many ways to what we used to have. You know, and if we go back in the olden days when, you know, if it was our grandparents were talking to each other, or our great-grandparents, or our great-great-grandparents, I would come to you with a bushel of wheat. And I'd say, Denis, you know, I would like to, you know, I'd like to have a basket, or I'd like to have a box of apples. And you had the apples and I had the wheat, and we would peer-to-peer, we would do a transaction, and we would exchange things. And this takes us back to the earliest forms of credit. This has been found to be something called Raistones, R-A-I. And these are limestone circles which were quarried in one Pacific island, and then they were road sailed 300 miles, 500 kilometers to another Pacific island. And the people that paid for the mining and paid for all the work to do, proof of work, they actually owned these stones, and they put them outside typically their house. And then someone would come along, and the unit of measurement, I don't know if you can see my finger from my thumb to my little finger, that amount was a large pig or a large canoe for six people. And they literally went around the stone like that and measured it all off. And this was a form of credit. Now, interestingly, the stone itself never moved. The stone just stayed outside, say, your house. But everyone in the community knew that you didn't own that stone, because you'd actually sold off in measurements like that to other people on the island. And it even went to the stage that some of the stones that you'd paid to actually be mined had actually sunk off the coast. So some of these stones were actually underwater. You couldn't see them, but people knew they were there. And the reason I sort of share that little story with you, A, it's the oldest form of credit, and we can learn so much from history. But secondly, you know, proof of mining these limestone circles, which are so heavy, they had a hole in the middle, a bit like a polo, where they used to put a bit of wood in so they could then pick them up and move them around. Well, proof of work. Well, that's Bitcoin. Proof of work. And if you look at the price of Bitcoin compared to how much it costs to make a Bitcoin, then you find quite a close correlation between the price of Bitcoin and the difficulty or the, how much it costs to actually make a Bitcoin. So we can learn a little bit there in terms of people saying, oh, a Bitcoin is worthless. Well, if you look how much it costs to make a Bitcoin, at the moment, it's around about $26,000, $27,000, depending on your location. It's a bit like a barrel of oil. The Saudis pump oil at $1 a barrel, whereas other jurisdictions, you know, they need a minimum of sort of $80 a barrel in order to sort of break even. So Bitcoin, if you stick it next to a Bitcoin miner next to a hydro generating plant, then the cost of making it a tiny compared to if you have to buy electricity to run your Bitcoin mining operation, say, in another country where it could be costing as much as $50,000 to produce a Bitcoin. So it's interesting how, when you say how things have changed, a lot's changed, but actually not very much changes very often when it comes to money.
So definitely a lot of different things. So let's look at blockchain and cryptocurrencies. You've been on this since the beginning, and I know especially in blockchain that you created as well, one of the most influential networks, that is Team Blockchain. That is a WhatsApp group, you and Thomas Power and other global influencers. So tell us about your history with blockchain technology, and how did you create this very influential, and how you've been coping as well with all the iterations of the blockchain technology and cryptocurrencies, because it's been a lot of waves, let's put it that way, and they still are.
Okay, so as I say, I was intrigued by the fact that blockchain technology could bring about much more transparency. And with that transparency, you wouldn't need to have separate records of account. And so therefore, particularly from as an ex sort of fund manager running a fund management business, you end up having custodians and trustees and administrators and all sorts of different parties, but they're all broadly looking at the same sort of information. And so it seemed to make a lot more sense to use a technology that you could actually then have the operation to be much, much more efficient. The trouble was that the technology really became to notoriety out of fear and greed. And I know you well remember back in 2018 when we saw the price of XRP. In 1 year, it went up 38,000%. And because of that, people were, you know, jumping on a bandwagon and saying, I want to invest in the next ICO. You know, Bitcoin's gone from 1 cent to one stage $64,000. And, you know, we've seen recently something called Pepe, which is a meme coin, and it's gone from, you know, almost nothing. And at one stage, if you'd have put $250 into it, it was worth something like $20 million. So I can understand why people are interested in cryptocurrencies, but I think you have to bear in mind the bigger picture. And the bigger picture is that cryptocurrencies are valued at around about $1 trillion. So I don't want to belittle it, but that's actually not a very much, that's not a big sum of capital when you look at it, because the debt markets are around about $90 trillion. Equity markets, about $110 trillion. Funds, if you look at the funds market, according to PwC, they're going to be over $150 trillion by 2025. And then real estate, well, that's just a tiddling $326 trillion, according to Savills. And then the big daddy of them all is obviously the derivative sector. You know, and that comes in at $1.2 quadrillion. And Denis, I have no idea how many zeros that is, but it's a lot of zeros. So if you can use the technology in sort of assets and funds and market, real estate or derivatives, then that's what's going to change society. That's got an impact on people's lives. Whether you make a lot of money or lose a lot of money on crypto, it won't change society. Whereas using technology to make it more open, fairer, and accessible and cut costs, that's really what many, many people are very interested in. And certainly in the regulated space, it's almost the holy grail. How do I have less risk but lower costs? And that's just normally, you can't sort of synchronize those. They're juxtaposed normally. To have less risk, you can have more compliance people. But with this, what we're seeing now is the ability to cut out some of the counterparties, disintermediate, be decentralized, as you mentioned the word earlier on. And funny enough, we're going back to that, the bushel of wheat and the box of apples, I peer-to-peer. And that then presents a big challenge, because talking to some people week before last in China, and they've been talking about the digital one. And they're having to now look at redefine the definition of money, because the Chinese don't allow one company to another to actually transact. That's illegal. You have to go through a third party because they're worried about fraud and corruption and things like that. So they've introduced a form of payment which allows that, but they don't want it. And so that's why we're now seeing the Chinese government actually, in conjunction with the Saudis and the Thai government and obviously the Hong Kong Monetary Authority, they've created something called Enbridge. And that is a decentralized, it's a DLT type structure for a central bank digital currency that they're looking to create, as opposed to the digital currency, which is not run on a blockchain, which is what the Chinese have. So we have to be careful of unintended consequences. And I think that's an example there. The Chinese want to create a digital currency, but suddenly realize they had to go back to the core and redefine what money is almost.
Yeah, and this brings us to the present situation that we are in terms of the present state of blockchain digital currencies, which, like you mentioned, is very small in the fraction of the derivatives and the capital markets industry worldwide is a tiny fraction. And as well, there's a massive bubble as well there that no one knows what is going on. But I want to come back to, you've been involved in projects, in research, and in networks. Tell us a bit about that work, because in the end of the day, like you said, a lot of these things happen within networks, within research. And these networks are very important because I learned from you, we share information, and we engage. And I know that you've been very dynamic on that. I don't know if you know, talk about especially some of your organizations, especially Team Blockchain, Digital Bytes, and other things that have been working on this.
Well, yeah. What I've seen over the last 7 or 8 years is a very different way of doing business, Denis. In historically, companies were like this. They created like, this is my information. This is my unique way of doing something. And they built walls and gates so that their competitors couldn't actually get in. And they tried to compete very, very vigorously with their main competitors, and it was very much a 1980s he who has most money wins type attitude, and it was all about the money. But society has changed and moved on, and we see a much greater degree of collaboration in markets than we've ever seen, and we see people who are fierce competitors coming together and actually saying, no, let's create a product or a service that works for the benefit, not just my clients, but your clients as well. And this is seen in, for example, there's a project Canton in Switzerland, whereby you've got three or four of the major banks and companies like Microsoft and Deloitte all coming together to say, let's create a platform that we can then trade these new digital assets together. Or you have EDX, which is a new digital platform just launched in the USA. And you've got people like eToro and Charles Schwab. These are fierce competitors, but they've come together to say, no, let's create something whereby collaboratively we can work together. Or in the oil industry, you have VACT, V-A-K-T. And this was a supply chain solution for the North Sea, because you'd have BP would have a rig, Esso would have a rig, and Total would have a rig. And they'd all be sending out three different boats to take grease or pipes or fuel or whatever to their separate rigs. And they said, no, this is crazy. Why don't we have one central place, one boat, and it takes the three supplies? And it's actually improved the efficiency in the North Sea by around about 30%. And now it's being rolled out in other jurisdictions and other locations around the world. So a great way of how collaborative capitalism can actually be much, much more sustainable, much fairer to the environment. You're still having very fierce competition, but you're competing on different in different ways and being more efficient in that sense.
And coming back to your own events and your own initiatives, do you want to talk about that? Because I would like to, I know that there's a lot of work you put together in events, in network, in talks. And I think this is as important as this part of the network, I feel, for me, has been, of course, depends on how much attention you put on it, but it's been a fantastic element of learning. For instance, when there's a new thing, if you are in a peers network, and I know that your work on that has been fantastic. I would like to highlight that if you want to talk about it.
Okay, well, you're very kind. So I suppose the first thing I'd like to stress is that incorrectly, I sometimes get referred to as an expert in this area. And I realize that the more I do that, the less I know, the less I really understand about, you know, the blockchain and the digital asset space. And I personally spend probably about 20 hours every week, and have done so now for the last 6 years, just reading and researching and saying, well, if that's happened, what does that mean? Who does that impact on? And tried to share that information and run regular sort of meetups and conferences and looking at and trying to get from startups through to, you know, IBM or Aberdeen Asset Management or FedEx to come along and say, can you share your thoughts? Why do you hate the technology, or why do you love the assets? And this way, try and, you know, put a pinprick in the ego. I'm not really so interested in your opinion. I'm interested in your experience, and share that in a very impassionate way, because we can learn from each other so much. And I say different industries. And I gave you the example of the petrochemical industry, the oil company, whereby essentially they were learning from what's happening in the retail market. And I've seen this time and time again. And we're going to see this more and more, I think, as the metaverse takes hold, that this something is, metaverse is often thought as in the gaming industry. But I think the metaverse has got more opportunities for healthcare and for training than probably the gaming industry. And so the network effect of reaching out to people, of helping people, and you soon find out, you know, there's lots and lots of people, all they want to do is suck your ideas, take your information, not pay for you. There's a lot of that that goes on. But there's also a lot of people, if you're fair and you help people, as someone told me years and years ago, if you tell the truth long enough, you get caught. Because actually, it's really easy to tell the truth. You've got to be Einstein to lie all your life, because you don't know what you've told someone. So it's much easier to tell the truth. But if you're telling fibs, then eventually people say, yeah, but that isn't what you said last time. And so that's been a very strong sort of driver in the business to say, okay, sometimes we don't know. And when we do know something, it's not necessarily our view, we'll back it up. So we use a lot of hyperlinks, Dennis. So if we say that this company is the most profitable or the biggest, or, you know, I don't know, a company uses the metaverse for market research like Louis Vuitton, we'll follow that up with a hyperlink to an article in Vogue or into the FT or Singapore Straits or CNBC or whoever. So that also gives additional reading around the subject, so people can then understand more about the topic that we're talking about. So very much rather than being egotistical and opinionated, we're trying to share information and education with one eye back on what's happened in the past, because as you correctly say, that can give a guide to what might be coming in the future.
And from these events, and I've been in a lot of these events where you have major global organizations from legal to startups and a lot of different things, especially when it comes to blockchain technology, that has been going through a massive disruption. But it's still, if you compare blockchain technology, we just mentioned metaverse, of in AI, it's a very tiny drop in the ocean. But in the end of the day, it's very disruptive because of it. It touches everything about identity, about supply chain, about all these different areas. But from these events and this kind of network they've been doing, what do you think are the major issues when it comes to adoption? When it comes even to all the myths, because if you and me go and speak to anyone in banking about cryptocurrencies, we probably will be banned. Although all of them are trading and some of them are speculating heavily on that. Right. So how do you see this kind of issues around, especially the blockchain, the cryptocurrencies in particular?
Okay, well, first of all, in blockchain, I get a lot of people say, oh yeah, but it's, the blockchain isn't developed. It's not fast enough. Well, maybe you need to go and have a chat with Broadridge, a US company that trades $2 trillion a month in the repo market. So, blockchains are very scalable, very fast, and they're solving real problems right now. A report came out yesterday talking about Nike and Starbucks. They reckon it could be worth, and they're issuing, Starbucks have got the Odyssey program, whereby they're issuing NFTs. And it's part of their marketing mix. And they reckon in the next 5 years, that could be worth $1 billion of extra revenue to those two companies. So when people are a bit skeptical about the technology, I always ask them, just put in blockchain plus whatever industry you're in, whether media, fashion, agriculture, finance, bank, and you'll be amazed at the number of articles and examples in your country and overseas of how the technology has been used. As far as cryptocurrencies are concerned, cryptocurrencies at one level cover a lot of different things, because in theory, a cryptocurrency could actually be any digital asset, because a cryptocurrency is an asset which is being secured against using cryptographic technology, i.e. using blockchain. But the typical cryptocurrencies that we think of, there's 22,000 of them. And out of those, there's about 9,000, which are still being actively traded. But I see cryptocurrencies very much like smaller companies. Institutions don't buy smaller company shares. They typically get their exposure buying a smaller company fund, and they leave the actual research, the trading of the shares to professionals, and that's all they focus on. So you get specialist US smaller companies or UK or European or Asian smaller company funds. So rather than trying to pick the winning one or two out of that 22,000 portfolio, then maybe people should put their money in a fund. And we're seeing more and more funds that just invest in cryptocurrencies. And it makes a lot of sense, but 3 or 5% of your money in smaller companies, maybe the same sort of thing you'd put into gold and silver, maybe the same you put into crypto. But that still leaves you with at least 80% of your money. And that 80% of your money will actually end up being in traditional assets such as equities, bonds, and property. But just on that, Denis, I found some fascinating research recently from Goldman Sachs and Knight Frank. And they found that high net worth investors have about 5% of their money in alternative investments. Whereas if you're a super high net worth, and they came up with a number of 30 million. So if you've got 30 million of assets, then you'll have 43% of your money in alternative investments. And these alternative investments are things like, antiques, private equity, hedge funds, watches, wine, venture capital funds. So, and what we're now seeing is the digitalization of some of these investments, which will enable people to actually, smaller investors, to get access to these areas which typically they couldn't get access to. So a good example of that is a specialist venture capital company called KKR, and they have recently digitized their $4.5 billion strategic health fund number two. Now, KKR only ever used to sell to private clients, to institutions. Now, private clients will be able to get access to that sort of area. So that's a good example of how we're seeing democratization coming into place.
That is the key element as well, especially for everything happening on the industry. And this democratization is just going to be bigger. But one of the challenges I find from my experience on the blockchain and crypto industry, where I've been as well for a long time, is definitely the layers of understanding, the lack of understanding. And as well, like you mentioned, there's people that look at this from a technology perspective when it comes to blockchain, perspective of speculation, and perspective as well of solving problems. So on Digital Bytes, you actually are looking at a lot of these case studies, a lot of different areas that you have. And of course, for people listening to us, they can look at your profile on LinkedIn and a lot of different social medias where we actually been doing it as well in YouTube. So from your areas that you've been doing research, I don't know if you want to highlight a couple of case studies, especially when it comes to the blockchain industry at the present, because the industry has been going for a lot of things, that you are more fascinated, especially on your research, that you would like to share with our audience.
Yeah, one of the areas, I think, I suppose I'm quite interested in the infrastructure that's required. So what I mean by that is if you take custody if you were to be appointed the executor of someone's estate, Denis, and you found out that they had some digital assets, so it could be maybe they've actually digitized their home records, or maybe they've got maybe they've bought a Lamborghini and the Lamborghini has an NFT, for example, or maybe they've just got a little bit of Bitcoin. As the executor, how do you know where those assets are? How secure they are? How do you hold them? And so this whole area of custody becomes really, really important. And I think this is one of the drivers behind the recent application from the biggest fund manager in the world, BlackRock, and companies like Fidelity, Invesco, and WisdomTree, and 21Shares, all looking to create a Bitcoin ETF. And one of the reasons for that is that it's much easier to hold an ETF than it is to physically hold well, you don't ever physically hold Bitcoin. You just hold a digital version in your wallet somewhere. And one of the things that we have to do is find a way to make the infrastructure and the user experience much more user-friendly. So we've seen companies like Copper, Metaco, CustodeX, all of these are coming up with solutions. And this is really, really important because if you take companies like Chubb, Securicle, Brinks Matt, historically, they had lots of little safe deposit box, which people put typically cash into. But cash is becoming increasingly harder and harder to use and spend. And, you know, if you take France, for example, it's illegal to spend more than 1,000 euros in cash in that country as a French citizen. The Spanish reduced the amount from 3,500 to 1,000 last year. So again, if you wanted to spend more than 1,000 euros, it's potentially a two-year prison sentence. So there's the need for these little safe deposit boxes. You don't want cash because it's very difficult to spend it. So they're having to reinvent themselves and say, well, okay, so we know you've got some jewelry or some paintings in these safe deposit box. What about creating an NFT for you? How do we actually utilize what you've already got in a different way? Now, at an extreme, NTT, the huge Japanese telephone company, they're embarked on a 5-year project with the Vatican. And they are digitally rendering and creating NFTs for the entire Vatican treasury. Now, some of these artifacts haven't seen the light of day for potentially hundreds of years. And they're going to be recorded and photographed. And then the Vatican are looking at potentially creating NFTs and selling these NFTs and generating revenue. Now, typically a museum only has 5% of its treasures on display. So you've got 95% tucked away where people have forgotten about them, or maybe they're not being kept correctly in the right conditions. Well, if you could actually have a digital version of those, then why couldn't you then actually have it much more inclusive? And we saw this in the chapel in, the brain's completely gone, in Florence, the Uffizi Gallery. In COVID, they sold a Michelangelo painting, the only NFT of this Michelangelo painting from 1560. And they sold it to an American lady who, her husband had always wanted a Michelangelo and she couldn't afford the original. So she bought the NFT for $150,000. Well, that was the equivalent of nearly 6,000 visitors going into the Uffizi Gallery. So the digital landscape is changing, but how do you hold and secure these assets? And that comes back to custody. So custody is something which I think is really, really important. And we're beginning to see more attention being paid to that, because if you're the executor of someone's will, you want to be able, you shouldn't really take that job on unless you know where all the assets are. And you don't know where all the assets are because, you know, most people have a private wallet that are in this space and they have a password. And with a password, they have these horrible, memorable words, which you've got to get in the right. And you give that to your mother, your brother, your lover. Well, you know, your mother dies, you have a row with your brother and you fall out with your lover. Well, who's got access to your information? Because if they've got access to your information, they could potentially steal it. So therefore, it's an interesting conundrum there. What do you do with your information to keep it in a very, very secure manner? And it's not just cryptocurrencies. This is going to be, as I say, the deeds of your home, your vehicle information, your portfolio, your healthcare data. So lots and lots of information, and that's going to create challenges how we keep it. But don't worry, they've already thought about some of this because Apple have just launched their advanced data protection system. So you can now lock your phone. So the only person in the world that can get access to your phone is you. So you're now going to have to think about, how do I secure access to my access on my Apple phone? So it's becoming more and more mainstream, I suppose. That's the main thing I'd like to get across.
No, it's already mainstream completely. You can, like you said, you can go from Prada to Louis Vuitton and get NFTs and engage with that. But still, there's a lot of layers, because of course the adoption is very small still, and as well there's a lot of issues as well, where you conserve it, how we do it, how we make this, all these bridges. So let's I know that I'm conscious about your time, so I want to be respectful. So in terms of the financial markets, and especially, for instance, you've been in some of your posts, been talking about, so we have regulators and we've been working with regulators as well. Right now, we have the US panicking. We have the US, the UK, actually, after a lot of years, we finally have some regulation in the UK. And as well, we have Chinese, you have Singapore, you have Malta, you have Gibraltar. So there are a lot of, and you mentioned Switzerland, a lot of regulators have a lot of different opinions, but there's not an international consensus around digital currencies and even blockchain-related technologies. One thing is pure blockchain certification, but when it comes to bridges, there's a lot of much more concerns. So how do you see this kind of fragmentation and as well, in some cases, I would say paradoxes, because you have what is happening, for instance, in the US is very concerning, but at the same time, it doesn't make any sense in a lot of ways because they're reversing, but just creating chaos, even in public companies like Coinbase. So I would like to see how you see this, I would say, chaos of, or lack of regulation worldwide.
Okay, so we're doing this recording in July 2023, and the reason I wanted to draw attention to listeners and viewers of this is that in the last couple of weeks, we've seen the Law Commission of England and Wales issue their recommendations on digital assets. And a lot of people say, yeah, well, so what, who cares what's happening in England and Wales? Well, you need to care, because 80% of all global trade is conducted using English law. 90 jurisdictions use English law as the basis of how to settle contracts and disputes and such like. And basically, the Law Commission has given some very helpful recommendations to give real legal clarity around digital assets and their obligations and responsibilities and things like that. And from that legal clarification, we will get regulatory clarification. We'll also enable to have companies to provide insurance, and other companies will be much happier to provide lending and finance, because if you haven't got a legal definition, why would you want to lend against it? So this is something which is really, really important. And I'm not sure whether it's just coincidence. I don't think it is. We've also seen something called the Bill of Lading. These are sort of bits of paper to move goods around the world. And again, bearing in mind that 80% of all trade is carried out using English common law, what we're seeing is 25 billion bits of paper currently being generated per annum to move goods around, you know, move a TV from China to New York, for example. And as we start to see the digitization of this documentation, we're going to see more and more people, whether they realize it or not, being exposed to it. Denis, you and I don't go around and say, oh, Denis, I've had a really good day at the office. I used my Excel spreadsheet and I was doing pivot tables all day long. We don't talk about the technology. We don't have an argument that Lotus Notes is better than Excel. And, you know, the days of arguing about VHS and Betamax, long finished, because actually no one uses video or tapes at all. So the discussion around technology is going to become less and less relevant. But what we need is proper legal clarity in order then for the regulators to take place. And I think that the UK has been slow, and I think deliberately slow, because the UK regulation is very much, we want you to operate in the spirit. We do not want to be definitive. And unfortunately, our cousins across the pond, the Americans, they tend to have very hard and fast rules and regulations. If you break them, then we'll take you to prison or fine you lots and lots of money. Whereas, you know, certainly the Europeans have a much more, almost a consensus, a sort of, are you operating in the spirit? What were you trying to do? And we are at the edge of legal definitions, without a doubt, and therefore regulatory definitions. And we don't have any hard and fast rules or something. And we're kind of feeling our way. And we've seen that with MiCA in Europe. They've almost ignored NFTs and said, well, it's just too difficult to handle. Let's get digital assets sorted out in the next couple of years, and then we'll come back to it. But meanwhile, we're seeing regulated exchanges in Switzerland and in Singapore. You've got Archax here in London. You've got Swarm in Germany. And these are allowing these digital assets to be traded and exchanged 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And that opens up huge opportunities. So rather than you being able to buy and sell your investment in your ISA or your pension, Denis, with Schroders, let's say, and you can deal once a day at 12 o'clock with Schroders, you take the same fund and now you can deal 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and you've got four or five market makers making the price. So you've got more choice, you've got more flexibility, and the underlying asset managers are able to actually hopefully settle and pay that back to you, you know, within hours, not T plus two. So it's a better service for you. So it'll get driven by regulators who say, well, you can go that Karen doing once a day paper-based systems, or we can do 24/7 in a much more regulated, safer and secure manner. So I think it's going to be compliance and regulation that will drive adoption, not salespeople, which it was 3 or 4 years ago.
I completely subscribe. And it's a key element how we can actually put all of, first of all, the information, the people in the different parts working together, which is a big challenge. And I know that networks and interviews and different parts, it's really important. But there's a pressure on this. So last question, and I want to be respectful. So we touch metaverse, we touch digital assets, but at the moment we are in the process of web one to web two. And at the moment we talk about the concept of web three or web 3.0, depends on how you see it, or the immersive web, or like you mentioned, metaverse, I would say metaverse enterprise, metaverse different areas that are right now. And this is already a much bigger industry than actually all the cryptocurrencies together. And, how do you see this bridge, especially with Web3? And you touch identity, you touch digital assets, you touch all these things, but especially, do you think we can actually have a Web3 when we have all the problems that you just mentioned, the regulatory part, but innovation will not stop? And of course, with Apple Vision Pro, definitely there'll be a lot of things coming, even if it's a bit delayed and all the stuff, but the technology is here, it's just a question of time. It can go in multiple directions. So I would like to hear a bit of from their industry involvement and engagement, what do you see? Probably some of the directions you see the Web3, or when can we actually get into that or not?
Okay, so Web3 I think is fascinating. If you look at the analysis from people like Boston Consulting Group or from Citibank, they're predicting by 2030 the metaverse could be 2.5 times the size of the Japanese economy. The Japanese economy is the third biggest economy in the world. So they're talking about somewhere between $8 and $13 trillion a year in terms of the size of the market. And I think it's going to start creeping in without us realizing. I mentioned a minute ago, Lamborghini. Lamborghini sold its last Aventador Coupe for $1.6 million at Sotheby's last year with an NFT. Without that NFT, it's questionable how valuable is that car? Because how do you prove the gearbox number, the chassis number, the engine number is what it should be? Because that's all contained within the NFT. So we're going to start seeing these things being merged and linked in at a much smaller level. We're already seeing, Rolex watches being effectively auctioned off so you can borrow money against your Rolex watch and you only have to pay 12% a year as opposed to, 3 to 10% per month by taking your Rolex watch to a pawn shop. So what we're beginning to see is slowly, people are embracing this and realizing this is a more efficient way to borrow money, lend money, and also to we mentioned before in the fashion industry, to do market research, to create a digital version of a product, which is super environmentally friendly. So you're not actually physically creating it. And these virtual handbags are selling for more than the actual handbags. And then in the whole education area, look at Accenture. Accenture recruited 150,000 people using the metaverse. Why? Because, Denise, let's take you to our Paris office. And here we go. This is the view from the office. But right, we're now going to take you to Total in the Gulf of Mexico. This is one of our oil rigs for a client. Oh, and now we're going to go down to Bordeaux and look at some of our biggest vineyards. Oh, and now we're going to go to a fromagerie in the Alps. And that whole immersive experience suddenly becomes much more memorable. And as far as AI is concerned, I think this is really important. AI is about knowledge. It's about being able to have access to information. Now, a lot of the AI at the moment, it's not intelligence, it's access to information. And I think that's what we should think of it. It's not giving expertise. In time, it will, but you need an expert to ask the right question. You need someone like you to be able to Google the right thing to be able to find it. All that we're seeing with ChatGPT at the moment is just bringing this information in a more user-friendly way. And that's kind of what technology needs. It needs to have less geekiness about it and be more accessible, amenable for individuals. And Facebook did a fantastic job, for billions of people because it became a way to use technology without them realizing they were using technology and sending electronic messages and pictures and the like. And I think we've learned from that, and we're going to see a real acceleration in that digital environment of the metaverse and actually help to be much more inclusive on a global basis, if nothing else.
I completely subscribe. I want to thank you for your time, Johnny. I think probably I will push you to a second one, probably more on the blockchain and cryptocurrencies. It's the first one here. Thank you. I got you here. So thank you so much for being here. For people listening to us, where can they find you?
Well, the best bet is LinkedIn. Or if you want a weekly newsletter, then just go to digitalbytes.substack.com, and we have a weekly which we send out to people, and it really gives some of the examples I've given today, showing how, where, who, why, and where the technology is being. There's no investment recommendations, no advertising. It's meant to be thought-provoking and educational. We make our money by having companies that can use our content, but it goes out freely to about 20,000 people. So feel free to sign up and we'll get a copy to you.
Thank you. I wish you all the continuous success, and we'll put all these links here for people listening. Thank you. All right.